Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. Welcome to the Hoban Minute. Today, we are joined by what can only be described as a triumvirate of cannabis industry legal experts. I'm talking, of course, about Bob Hoban, Patrick Goggin, and Garrett Graff, three of the major forces behind the Hoban Law Group. And we have an interesting conversation and topic on the table today, and I figured the best way to present it is to go exactly what this person who was submitting a question to Westword, a popular magazine here in Denver, they submitted a question to the editorial team and they said, what did the DEA do to CBD this time? That seems to be the question. We know that there was an IFR published by the DEA back in August, and there are a lot of folks out there who just need a little bit more context for why this is problematic and what actions the industry is taking at large to combat this. So before we jump into all of that, I just want to make one comment that yesterday was important. It marked the last day for public comment from when the DEA published that interim final rule in late August. This was the closing of the period for people to submit comments to them. And before we get really deeply into what is going on right now as it relates to the DEA and the hemp industry, let's look at history. There's been previous cases with the Hemp Industries Association, the HIA, and the DEA. And I think in order to really understand the weight of everything that's going on now, I'm going to open up the floor to you three gentlemen to give us some history on the weight of all of this.
Well, thank you for setting the table, Eric. And yes, ultimately, the DEA, generally speaking, is not friendly to industrial hemp. It doesn't like what Congress has done. And there is a historical detail that goes back and forth. And a lot of people will say that the DEA is out to get the hemp industry or the CBD industry, if such a thing exists. And I would characterize it differently. I would characterize it as a case of the DEA versus Congress. It's been a volley back and forth of exerting strength and showing power and showing resistance for, 20 years plus or minus to date, if not longer, involving this plant. So let's talk about that historical detail as you described, and I'd like to turn to Patrick to that. But before I do, again, it's the DEA that is just not comfortable with hemp being separated for a variety of reasons. Number one, it's difficult to identify the difference between a hemp and a marijuana plant because the DEA strictly adheres to its mandate, which is to enforce the Controlled Substances Act. Of course, marijuana, the distinction between marijuana and hemp for those listeners, and I think that everybody knows this by now, but let's be clear on this. 0.3% THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, which is the psychoactive cannabinoid, the psychoactive compound within the cannabis plant that produces the high, okay? So this is why marijuana was designated as a Schedule 1 substance, and the DEA guards that Schedule 1 marijuana enforcement mandate with great vigor. Now, as the line between marijuana and industrial hemp softens and industrial hemp becomes a regulated agricultural crop on its way to becoming a commodity, or at least the process components of the plant will ultimately become commodities, the DEA continues to express its discomfort because of its suspicion that people will game the system, cultivate marijuana plants under the guise that they're hemp plants, create illicit black market activity, create a way to generate cash, which would then flow into other criminal or narcotic enterprise. The idea that hemp is to be treated as something other than marijuana is not something that the DEA tends to embrace. And that's not surprising, particularly given the history, but it's not surprising given the DEA's mandate, which is to strictly enforce and to acknowledge and expressly provide for protection of those controlled substance principles. So to understand some more context, Patrick, why don't you take us back to the early 2000s? Because you have been involved in the legal capacity plus in with this plant, with industrial hemp, with the DEA for quite some time, near 20 years or thereabouts. And you were counsel in the first HIA versus DEA case. And give us a little context, a little color based on your experience with some detail about the DEA's position and perception and treatment of industrial hemp.
Yeah, thanks, Bob and Eric. Good to be here. Really happy to join you guys in this unprecedented time. The history really starts in 2000. I mean, after, of course, the war on drugs and the rise of the DEA, with something that was, there was a memo that came from the ONDCP to the DEA that essentially said that hemp is a stalking horse for marijuana, and we want you to develop and issue rules that would essentially stop the human consumption of hemp foods, because it their concern is that it's at least the documented concern was that it was going to lead to the legalization of marijuana. Ultimately, what the DEA did in 2001 was they issued a series of rules, both interpretive rules that did not require notice and comment and went into immediate effect, as well as proposed rules to try to substantiate and conform with notice and comment as they saw it. And essentially what they did was say, through adding the terms naturally occurring to the definition of THC, that any substance that has any naturally occurring THC in it is a controlled substance.
And Patrick, let me just jump in right there, just for our listeners, just to clarify this point. Under the Controlled Substances Act, the word marijuana is defined as a Schedule I substance. That's marijuana with an H. But there's another component of the plant, as Patrick just pointed out, and I'll turn it back to you, Patrick, in just a moment, but that is THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, is in fact separately defined as an independently controlled substance, separate from marijuana. So that's what this word naturally occurring, that's why this case in the early 2000s and that battle was so significant, because the court made the distinction in the early 2000s between synthesized THC and naturally occurring THC, or naturally occurring cannabinoids, meaning naturally occurring within a plant. So, Patrick, pick it up from there. I just wanted to make sure that we had that baseline.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, of course. And so what the industry did was they went in and challenged these rules initially, based on not following certain procedures, but ultimately saying, looking at the definition of marijuana that was adopted in 1970 when the Controlled Substances Act was passed from the original Marijuana Tax Act that was passed in 1937, it looked at the definition of marijuana that had exemptions in it. And the exempt parts of the plant were the stems and stalks, the sterilized seed, and the cake made therefrom. And what essentially the court concluded was that Congress, at the time that definition was initially adopted in 1937 and then ultimately again in 1970, that Congress knew what it was doing and that it exempted hemp from, or at least hemp parts, the parts of the hemp plant, not necessarily the hemp plant itself, because that was, as of 1970, was still deemed to be a controlled substance, but the parts of the plant that are used in numerous products, both on the food side and industrially and whatnot, the court concluded that those of the plant were exempted from the definition of marijuana, and what the DEA was actually engaged in was a scheduling action. For the first time in that court case, for the first time in American jurisprudence history, the court referred to non-psychoactive hemp. And what the court said was that DEA was engaged in a scheduling action of non-psychoactive hemp. It did not go through the proper procedures for a scheduling action, and therefore the law was held invalid.
So then spinning forward, 2016, December of 2016, the DEA comes out with a rule, a drug code, that defined marijuana extract. And by using the term marijuana extract, the definition included all extracts from the industrial hemp plant because of the way that it was written, which could also allude to, of course, CBD, which by 2016 was a major industry, was a major product being produced and sold in the marketplace. But before we get to 2016, because that sets the table for where we are today, and we'll get Garrett to weigh in on the current IFR by the DEA, the interim final rule. Patrick, what happened between those early 2000s and that ruling and 2016 with regard to hemp products in the marketplace and the DEA?
Well, as you alluded to, the ruling from the Ninth Circuit in the early 2000s allowed for the hemp industry to flourish, and it, you know, the evolution of the industry really flowed from hemp foods into then the cannabinoids, and we're not talking about THC, the cannabinoid that gets is the psychoactive cannabinoid, but these other cannabinoids that you know serve various different purposes. But what during that time, the DEA continued to assert jurisdiction over the importation of hemp, while naturally occurring THC in food was lawful. They were still working at every angle and opportunity to throw confusion into the industry and to maintain its relevance. But what significantly happened between those cases in 2016 was the passage of the 2014 Farm Bill, and for the first time since after the Controlled Substances Act, we were allowed to cultivate hemp in this country, and so hemp was removed under those provisions of the 2014 Farm Bill from the Controlled Substances Act. And yet, at the same time, the DEA continues to subvert the intention of Congress and passage of the 2014 Farm Bill, as well as showing confusion on the ruling in the early 2000s, such that agencies are confused on the legality of hemp, misinformed on it, and thereby having significant negative impact on the industry and on, you know, understanding the laws in general.
And so there is a little bit more to that story as well, considering it is this historical back and forth between the DEA and Congress. To your point, Patrick, 2014, Farm Bill gets passed. For the first time in U.S. history, industrial hemp is separately defined. It's defined within the Farm Bill. It's created an exception for research purposes, for commercial, agricultural, and scientific purposes, and the industry flourishes. Now, what happens between 2014 and 2016 is also interesting because it depicts, it illustrates this battle between the DEA and Congress. Congress says, DEA, stay away from industrial hemp. And in fact, there was a budget rider called the McConnell Rider at the time, which specifically prohibited the DEA, the Department of Justice generally, from spending funds towards the enforcement of things that would otherwise fall under the 2014 Farm Bill. So that created confusion. And then that was renewed subsequently between 2014 and 2017. So Congress kept saying, DEA, no, stay out of industrial hemp. It's not within your purview. We're going to cut your spending abilities here. We're going to create clear laws. And then, of course, that drug rule comes around in December of 2016. And then that went to court in the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit ruled to the DEA that yes, industrial hemp has been separately defined from marijuana, and that the proscribes of the legislation itself allowed for market-based research, and that how can you have market-based research without a market, and that indeed derivatives from the plant were also deemed to be legal under the 2014 Farm Bill. So those were findings that the court made in 2018 when it ultimately ruled on the 2016 Farm Bill. Spinning forward, the CBD ingredient industry continues to grow. It continues to thrive. Investment comes in from all over the world. CBD is an ingredient in everything, in coffee shops, in massages, in pillowcases. So what happens in 2018? 2018, Congress passes the most sweeping cannabis reform in U.S. history, which was the 2018 Farm Bill, which removed those research limitations over industrial hemp. The industry continued to grow. We've seen the market dictate there's less focus on CBD and more focus on grain and fiber and other agricultural uses of the plant. But then here we are in 2020, and the DEA issues this IFR, this interim final rule. So, Garrett, talk a little bit about the interim final rule in 2020. What are some of the features of it? And let's begin a conversation about why this is problematic to the industry.
Certainly. Thank you, Bob, and welcome, everyone. Great to be here today. And, you know, when you start thinking about where we are today, it's just quite a continuation of much of the same over the course of history with the DEA. And it's not just the IFR, just within the past few weeks. Before, I believe it's the UN is considering how to internationally treat CBD, the U.S. representative to that forum set forth and asserted that the U.S. was not in favor of legalizing CBD because of the ability or the perception that doing so would undermine effective drug control, just like how DEA asserted that hemp is a stalking horse to marijuana decades ago at this point, right? And so I think it's important to kind of pick up on the characteristics and traits, the similarities between each of these instances that Patrick talked similarly, which sets the table then for this DEA IFR. One question I often hear is, you know, is the DEA acting intentionally or negligently? Certainly, I think some in the industry would presume intentionally, and perhaps they're right. I would suggest that in many cases, whenever challenged, the DEA says we're, you know, at best or at worst, rather, it was negligent, right? That we were simply trying to follow the rule of the law and do our jobs, which presents problems because their failure time and time again, if taking that as true, that they were simply being negligent and not taking care and being mindful of the word choices that they use, of providing things like due process and notice and comment periods and conferring with their sister agencies in order to create appropriate policies. Okay, first time, fool me once, fair enough. But the second time, the third time, and every single time subsequent thereto, can we really, you know, give DEA the benefit of the doubt? I think we become far more hard-pressed to do so. And so, you know, fast forward to this 2020 DEA's IFR, yet again, the DEA is asserting that they are acting consistent with the 2018 Farm Bill as enacted by Congress, that they're simply operating out of their regulatory authority and trying to help brighten that dividing line between hemp and marijuana. I mean, in rhetoric, that is what the DEA is supposed to do, right? At the end of the day, though, the words have to match that rhetoric, and that's where I think the IFR in 2020 falls short. And so to that point, what is the IFR this time around discuss? basically, it discusses a few other things. For example, it contemplates the descheduling of CBD as part of Epidiolex. Notably, that's a marijuana-derived form. Some, you know, might presume or suspect that there's now, you know, drug development and pharma companies at play and having, you know, some sort of interest in seeing the DEA police this line a little bit more harshly against the hemp industry. Again, who's to say? I'm not going to necessarily dictate whether that is or is not the case. But there's some other issues, you know, that are handled within the IFR that are perhaps less controversial. Controversially, though, you have a very bold statement for the DEA. Usually, you know, that they're very subtle and benign and vanilla, so to speak. A very bold statement that the fact that something is derived from hemp does not render that material lawful, which seemingly contradicts in its, you know, on its face, the definition of hemp being all parts of the plant below 0.3% THC, and notably, under the 2018 Farm Bill, the inclusion of cannabinoids, derivatives, and extracts derived therefrom. Now, understandably, there's some confusion as to how you could have raw hemp and wet cannabinoids, you know, be treated under the same definition. That's understandable, and we can get into that. But still, to make that bold statement, without having gone through due process, without having talked to its sister agencies, the USDA and the FDA, who are expressly delegated the regulatory authority under the 2018 Farm Bill, without seemingly giving much thought to this, that's a striking statement to make. And then to further double down on that statement and say not, you know, that it's derived from hemp does not sanitize the compound. And furthermore, any extract above 0.3% THC is deemed marijuana. Again, seemingly benign in that instance, but taking the context of hemp, that's entirely problematic for three reasons in my mind. One, you look at the inclusion in the 2018 Farm Bill of a margin of error or measurement of uncertainty. Hemp needs to be tested at 0.3%, but within a margin of error, meaning guess what? You could have hemp that tests at 0.35, but if it's within that testing facility's margin of error, it's deemed to be treated as 0.3%. Well, DEA doesn't resolve that discrepancy, right? So one could argue that you're within the margin of error, but you're technically on the high side of it, and you're violative of the DEA's rule. Secondarily, when Congress legalized hemp, there was an intent to establish a robust industry, not a narrow one, not one predicated strictly on fiber. So when you start talking about having multiple varieties of hemp, both for fiber and for cannabinoid production, you're emphasizing cannabinoid production. As part of emphasizing cannabinoid production, you then need to produce CBD and now CBG and CBN and some of the other cannabinoids that are of interest. But guess what? You can't, genetically speaking, prioritize only one singular cannabinoid to the exclusion of another. So when you start increasing the potency of CBD, so too do you get THC alongside that. The entire framework of the Farm Bill and the corresponding USDA regulations are set up in a way to induce the farmers of our nation to grow hemp up to 0.3% THC, period. It's straight up inducement. The testing protocols and sampling protocols set forth discuss precisely how to run that line for those farmers. But when you take that hemp and you process 0.29% hemp, you're taking away a lot of what comprised that sample that made 0.29. You're taking away sticks, adulterants, stalk, stem, sterilized seed. So you're now contrasting a composite sample that tested 0.29% THC, and you've now stripped away 80% of the material, 70%, you know, whatever the number is, but a substantial amount of the material that comprised that sample. And what are you left with? Concentrated cannabinoids. That's not going to test below 0.3% THC, inherently, scientifically. And so with that in mind, you have this intermediate processing scenario whereby there's no way that DEA's statement can be read and given meaning consistent with the Farm Bill and Congress's intent and the intent of the USDA's regulations without almost entirely rendering moot the ability to produce cannabinoids. And lastly, one of the most popular products in the marketplace is THC, THC-free hemp products. But doesn't that necessarily mean that you've removed and isolated all the THC? So you're discarding and disposing of a highly concentrated, isolated THC compound? That's problematic. So those are several instances in which the rule is problematic. Secondarily, there's also then this blind reference to synthetic. And this has been read to go after other cannabinoids. For example, right now, one of the more popular ones being Delta-8 THC, quasi-psychoactive cannabinoid, perhaps with not as great potency of psychoactivity as Delta-9 THC. Many advocate that Delta-8 THC is lawful pursuant to the 2018 Farm Bill. And all of those arguments are well taken, but the DEA's rule baldly references synthetic. There's no definition. One could say, hey, that means it's, you know, laboratory created, but there's other more permissive definitions that suggest any tampering, any type of processing that you subject the material to renders it synthetic. So in that case, aren't all the cannabinoids, if that were the definition, aren't all cannabinoids then technically synthetic? I don't think that's the intent, but without a definition or a clarity from the DEA, which, by the way, maybe we could have rooted out that problem and that issue linguistically if the DEA had simply asked, given an opportunity for notice and comment, for due process, talk to its sister agencies. But nonetheless, here we are with an IFR that presents more issues than it resolves, despite the DEA's asserted best intentions.
So let me emphasize just a couple of points, and then Patrick, I want to get your thoughts on some of this stuff. And the point I want to emphasize is, why does this matter? Why is this so significant? Now, Garrett touched on it, but I want to just stress, every time you take biomass, hemp biomass from the field, that hemp biomass is harvested at 0.3% THC or below by dry weight. That's the definition. Once it is taken into an extraction facility, and once the cannabinoids are removed, there's certainly technology that would prevent this from occurring, but 95% or more of all extracts that come from that hemp biomass will always exceed 0.3% in the extraction process, because, as Garrett pointed out, you're removing other material, other biomass, you're concentrating the cannabinoids. So you're necessarily going to exceed 0.3%. The 2018 Farm Bill did not say that the extracts can never exceed 0.3% in any processing or manufacturing. And this is important too, because the 2018 Farm Bill also expressly said that THC from industrial hemp is no longer a controlled substance. So what gives here, Eric? It's a situation where the plant material is harvested at 0.3% or below. Every single processor in the world that's extracting it, with very few exceptions, is exceeding 0.3% in the processing and manufacturing. Under this IFR, all of that material would be deemed illegal and subject to the DEA's authority, despite the fact that THC from industrial hemp is no longer a controlled substance. Something doesn't give here, but that's the important thing that the industry needs to understand, that every single processor that operates every single day is violating this interim final rule and is potentially, and I stress potentially, subject to DEA law enforcement. Whether they have the resources to do so, that's a whole other story altogether. But that's the crux of why the IFR has exceeded the DEA's jurisdiction and has inserted itself in post-harvest processes, which are to be governed by the FDA and not the DEA, especially when that THC is no longer a controlled substance. So that's the crux of the problem. Now, Patrick, that would seem to affect, as I tried to describe, nearly every processor in the country. Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. I mean, the DEA is very clear that whenever hemp or derivatives of hemp rise above 0.3% THC, setting aside that standard and the rationality and reasonableness of that standard, that is the standard. Anything that rises above 0.3% becomes a controlled substance. And they do this in spite of the fact that the 2018 Farm Bill specifically says that the DEA no longer has jurisdiction over hemp. Jurisdiction sits and rests, regulatory authority rests, as you alluded to, Bob and Garrett, with the USDA and the FDA. It specifically removes from the Controlled Substances Act and the scheduling hemp and THC from hemp. So what authority does DEA have here? And what authority does DEA have to directly interfere with the congressional intent to authorize the unfettered commercialization of hemp in a time when our economy is obviously struggling with the pandemic, and yet hemp and agriculture has been deemed across the board is an essential activity and essential businesses. So what the DEA is effectively doing is it's interfering with our U.S. businesses and entrepreneurial efforts to grow jobs and the economy when we need it most. It's just a telling new example of DEA engaged in overreach beyond its jurisdiction in an attempt, I believe, to both remain relevant, and it's the tail wagging the dog of budget protection and directly resulting in economic loss for our businesses.
And so consequently, the Hemp Industries Association and Reed Botanicals, Palmetto Harmony, two CBD companies, have moved forward with a lawsuit. Our law firm is counsel of record, along with our friends at Yetter Coleman, Vicente Cederberg, and the Rod Kite Law Firm. And that lawsuit is actually two lawsuits. One is a technical challenge of the authority, judicial review, an appeal, if you will. Does the IFR withstand scrutiny under the law? That's been filed in an appellate court, and at the same time, in a district court, a trial court, a case has been filed for declaratory relief seeking to determine whether or not the DEA has indeed exceeded its authority. But Garrett and Patrick, let's play devil's advocate for just a moment here. Take the DEA's position in this. You alluded to it a minute ago, Garrett. Does the DEA do this with a straight face? Do you think the DEA has a good faith argument that what they've done does comport with the 2018 Farm Bill?
I mean, I think it's a good question. Part of it comes down to, and we may never know, precisely the answer is, is DEA doing this intentionally, or is it kind of tripping over its own feet into these corners time after time after time? And, by no means would I give them that much credit necessarily, but, we have to be pragmatic in understanding that we've seen this competition, these competing issues between Congress and DEA over the then current understanding of hemp time and time again. And if DEA can't keep up with scientific evolution of hemp, then of course it's going to keep on tripping over its own feet to a certain extent. But again, there's probably some level of complicity or intentionality involved here. What's the DEA's argument? They're trying to ensure that there are that psychoactive products are not making their way to the marketplace, right? The entire premise of Schedule 1, whether you agree with it or not, is that there's this creation and scheduling of substances based upon their ability to become hallucinogenic or psychoactive. So to the extent that there needs to be a bright line rule from the DEA as the acting authority to ensure that, consistent with Congress's intent through the CSA, that there not be psychoactive products put to market, I can at least understand, and there is, a straight-faced argument there. Do I necessarily think that it holds water or ultimately overcomes having been superseded by the 2018 Farm Bill? No. Truly, from my perspective, what the answer is DEA, while you're, you know, in that scenario, your intentions might, you know, be pure to a certain extent, but you can't just insert yourself with regulatory authority wherever you so please. Congress delegated USDA and FDA to regulate these things. So if you DEA want to work in collaboration with USDA and DEA, or an FDA, excuse me, as the authorities delegated with regulatory authority by Congress to establish that bright line rule, great. But doing so unilaterally is not the way to go. Guess what? You got your wrist slapped several years ago when you issued the statement of principles back right after the 2014 Farm Bill started. You did so in theory with your sister agencies, USDA and FDA, who soon distanced themselves from you. So let's learn from our past mistakes, grow, try to gain a better understanding of the plan itself, create the appropriate regulations where necessary to enforce the CSA as it stands today, as well as the intent of the Farm Bill. Because I think there is a rule and a bright line rule able to be drawn, but it's not one that the DEA alone can draw itself. And that's the that's where I think there's a faltering of the DEA's argument.
And I would add that it needs to be in conjunction with the USDA and the FDA that under the Farm Bill were granted jurisdiction. But, you know, playing devil's advocate, if you were to set that aside and look at this in a vacuum and just purely look at the definition of hemp, one could make the argument that the 0.3% THC applies to everything in that definition because it comes at the end, and that includes extracts along the way in the process. That said, to draw that conclusion, it remains that it flies in the face of congressional intent to allow for these products, and that implicit within that is extraction. It refers to extracts, and part of that definition of extract is that you are concentrating material. So it's understood the material will be concentrated during the process, and yet ultimately in the finished product, it will be brought back to 0.3% THC.
But Patrick, to counter that though, right, I think part of what we have to understand is that DEA's own fault though, if Congress poorly worded the 2018 Farm Bill. Why did Congress include cannabinoids, extracts, and derivatives within the existing definition, right? Think about that historically. The first definition of hemp was in the 2014 Farm Bill. It almost strictly contemplated cultivation, and it created a definition on dry weight basis, presumptively at harvest, right? You know, it's a dry raw material. Updating the definition 4 years later in 2018, Congress didn't create a hemp extract definition, which it could have or should have, but instead it just simply slapped in cannabinoids, extracts, and derivatives into the middle of the existing definition. So if that was a poor choice on Congress's part, isn't there a statutory fix there by Congress, and should that issue be imputed to DEA? I mean, it's an interesting argument. I don't necessarily know that, again, it holds logic all the way to the very logical, to the very end, but that's something that we have to consider, though, don't we, Patrick?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, Congress can go back and work on its definitions, but at the same time, Congress has clearly indicated that for DEA to get out of the way and for it to, regardless of the wording or the poor wording of the definition, for it to come and issue this IFR without consulting with the sister agencies, particularly the agencies that have jurisdiction over this, and to throw a monkey wrench into and chill the industry, it's not legally supported or supportable, in my opinion.
Well, and as I promised our listeners at the beginning of this episode, a dialogue with a triumvirate of cannabis legal industry experts. And I do think that I think you guys have done a wonderful job outlining the history and the context and really showing us and illustrating what the pattern is here. And I think what I'm really left with and what I think has been really poignant in what all of you have said is that it's very hard to misinterpret the 14 and 18 Farm Bill, in that it was trying to establish this as a new agricultural commodity. And so the fact that we see these efforts on the DEA's parts, it is a little bit disturbing. And I really liked what the Small Business Administration said, because what my interpretation of your guys' conversation has been is that it really is small businesses and perhaps processors who would be left holding the bag here if the DEA decided to really act on the language in that IFR and show up one day and take legal action. So I really enjoyed that the SBA provided public comment and basically said, you are hindering the industry and posing a risk and threat to small businesses out there who are trying to move and advance this industry forward here in the United States.
Yeah, there's something under the law, Eric, called the Regulatory Flexibility Act. The Regulatory Flexibility Act requires that when an agency is about to publish a rule, such as what the DEA has done with this most recent IFR, that it must first consult with other relevant agencies. The USDA and the FDA do not and have not taken kindly to this IFR because it does tend to infringe on their authority. But more importantly, if there's an economic impact that will occur by virtue of the rule being enacted, to your point, on small businesses, on the entire CBD industry across all of the United States, because every extractor seems to violate this rule and the rule doesn't have a basis in the law, that has an enormous economic impact to the tune of millions upon millions, if not exponentially millions upon millions of dollars. So that is ultimately a major problem here. Now, in conclusion, at least from my perspective, I would like to note that the HIA, of course, is a nonprofit organization, and there is a legal defense fund that has been established for those two lawsuits that I mentioned. And I do think it's incumbent on everyone in the industry to examine whether they can contribute $100, $500, $1,000, $5,000 or more, because the industry is literally riding on this decision. And Patrick, maybe you could tell us where to find a little bit more information about the Legal Defense Fund.
Yeah, just go to hemplegaldefensefund.com. That'll link you through to information on the lawsuit, on the opportunity to get in payments, the options, either through PayPal or through wires if it's larger than $1,000. We've done a lot and have been successful in garnering contributions from a number of great U.S. companies, but we need more. This is a long battle, and we need to expect that this will not be the last battle that we'll be facing, and the industry needs to continue to come together. I'd like to point out that this time around is really unique in that four law firms have come together as part of a unity team, and that collectively we are coming together, putting the best and brightest minds on this issue, and we'll see the DEA in court.
Well, thank you so much, Bob, Garrett, Patrick. It really is a pleasure to sit here with your brain trust and all of the really decades of experience and industry knowledge, institutional knowledge around the industry that you all bring. So thank you for the time today. Patrick, thank you for sharing that information around the Hemp Legal Defense Fund. Please go and check out more information on their website, and have a great day, all. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law, and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.